Welcome to the Science Podcast for July 27th, 2012. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Edward Hermy. This week, packing nanoparticles into complex structures, the next steps in planetary exploration, and a closer look at termites.
In social insects, they usually send the older ones outside to forage, to collect food, and so they are more implied in battles. And where they are old, then probably less efficient, they are more likely to sacrifice themselves.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Back in Chemistry 101, you may remember learning about cubic close packing, hexagonal close packing, and all the other basic arrangements that atoms and molecules can make when bonding with one another. But how would these atoms and molecules arrange themselves if you were to remove the chemical bonds? Seeking an answer to this question, Sharon Glotzer and colleagues investigated the self-assembly of nanoparticles in an environment dominated by entropy. Glotzer spoke with me about the study from her office in Michigan.
Everyone's familiar with different kinds of chemical bonds that hold atoms and molecules together. And entropy is related to a kind of statistical force. It's not a typical kind of chemical bond, but it's just as important in organizing building blocks like atoms and molecules into structures as chemical bonds. Entropy is a concept that's usually associated with disorder, colloquially. But it's not really. Entropy is about options. It's about possibilities. And what that means is that entropy can sometimes order stuff. That seems really counterintuitive, but it's actually been known for about 50 years. What wasn't known and what's so surprising to come out in this study is just how far you can go with entropy in organizing different sorts of shapes.
So you're talking about entropy specifically within the context of self-assembled materials.
That's right.
You say that these kinds of materials are ubiquitous in nature. Can you give a few familiar examples?
Sure. Broadly speaking, crystal structures can be formed by self-assembly. So if you take water and you put it in an ice tray and put it in the freezer, it turns into ice. And what's happened is that the water molecules have organized into a periodic crystal structure. And that's an example of a self-organization or self-assembly process where you didn't go in and place the molecules one by one into this ordered structure. The water figures out during the process of freezing how to organize all of the molecules.
Right.
So any sort of a crystal structure could be thought of as an example of that. But you can have other examples like in biology, cell membranes are self-assembled structures of lipids. Viruses are a classic example of a self-assembled structure where proteins self-organize into groups, and those groups that are called capsomers, again, self-organize into the virus capsid structure that contains DNA on the inside.
All right, so why were you interested in the role of entropy in the self-assembly of materials? What questions were you trying to address to answer in this study?
We want to design new materials. And to design new materials means we want to design new structures, and we want to design new structures in new ways. Structures for different kinds of materials can be made out of atoms, it can be made out of molecules. For the past 10 years, nanotechnologists have been making nanoparticles, which are clusters, small clusters, say, of atoms, which can be anywhere from a couple nanometers to a couple thousand of nanometers across. And those nanoparticles can also serve as building blocks of new materials, like next-generation materials that might have properties that you don't have today in traditional materials. So the goal of our study was to try to understand some general design rules, general principles for how the shape of nanoparticles can affect what kinds of structures they want to self-assemble into.
And in particular, the nanoparticles that you were studying, or basically the building blocks for these structures, were a group of 145 polyhedra. So tell me about these polyhedra.
So many nanoparticles are grown in solution as little crystallites, and so they naturally have this sort of faceted shape, like the shape of a diamond. So we decided to focus our study on these kinds of faceted shapes called polyhedra. Mm-hmm. And so we looked at a number of different kinds of polyhedra to see how changing the shape of the polyhedra, which means changing the faceting, would affect how these particles want to self-organize. So we started with the five platonic solids. Those are the five simplest ones. The tetrahedron is the simplest polyhedron of all because it has four sides, and that's the minimum number of sides that you need to form a polyhedron, you know, a three-dimensional shape.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing special about the number 145. We could have studied a few more. We could have studied a few less. These were some polyhedra that are highly symmetric.
So your next phase of work was to determine the structures that these polyhedra would form when self-assembled. But you weren't actually working with these materials. You were just running computer models of how they would all fit together. Is that right?
Yes. We don't make anything. We just do it all in the computer. And so we use computer simulation to solve the laws of thermodynamics. And when there are no chemical bonds, no interactions between particles, other than they can't sit at the same spot. Think of them like billiard balls.
Mm-hmm.
Thermodynamics dictates that the stable structure that will result will be the one that maximizes entropy. And then what we do in the simulations is we just start the simulation out with just a few particles in the box so they have lots of room, not very crowded. And then we start throwing more particles in, or making the box smaller for the same number of particles so that they start feeling more crowded. And at some point, they get crowded enough that the system realizes as a whole that if the particles start to align face to face, there are more ways for the particles to arrange themselves than if they stayed disordered.
Hmm.
And that's the part that's usually counterintuitive to people.
Indeed. So is there a way for you to then test these models and confirm whether or not they're accurate when you're outside of this hypothetical computer scenario?
Sure. Well, first, there are different kinds of rigorous tests that can be done to ascertain the stability of the kinds of structures, the correctness of the structures that you get. And then we work with a number of experimental groups here at the University of Michigan and at other places who can make the kinds of particles that we're simulating. And so they can test our predictions.
So in the end, what did you learn from modeling the self-assembly of all of these different polyhedra? How much are you now able to predict about the final structure, knowing the particular sizes and shapes of the building blocks going into it?
Well, we learned quite a few things. The first thing that we learned is that there is an incredible diversity of crystal and crystal-like structures possible with just shape alone and no chemical bonding, no other interactions. Mm. And that was surprising to us. The second thing we learned is that one can control all of these types of crystal structures just by controlling the shape of the particle, and that some of the structures that you get are incredibly complex. For example, we found some crystal structures that have 52 particles in the repeat unit, which is an extraordinary complex structure, even for atoms to form, let alone nanoparticles like this with no chemical bonding. So structures like that with 52 or 20 or even 8 particles in the unit cell are, to date, the most complex ordered structures that we're aware of from entropy alone, from just hard particles. Of course, structures of that level of complexity are known in classic materials, but it's not been found before with, say, nanoparticles that have no such metallic bonding.
So within your field and beyond, what's sort of the greater significance of this work, and what are some applications?
So it allows us for the first time to predict the category of structure that will come out by just looking at a particle shape. Without having to do an experiment or do a simulation, we can take a particle shape and predict whether or not it will form, say, a very simple type of crystal with a very small repeat unit, or a much more complex crystal with a much more complex repeat unit, or whether it will form a liquid crystal, like the kind that you might find in a liquid crystal display.
Hmm.
Not made out of the same molecules, of course, but the same sort of structure. Or we can tell whether or not that shape is likely to self-assemble into a structure called a plastic crystal, where the particles are free to spin in place. there are many types of crystal structures that nanotechnologists would like to be able to obtain through self-assembly, because it's just not practical to build them by placing every nanoparticle where you want it in some mechanical process.
Mm-hmm.
So you just want them to self-assemble by the bucket. And so now we can tell them, well, if you want this particular kind of structure, then your nanoparticle should have this kind of a shape. That was not possible before. So the greater significance is that we now understand that entropy can get you a lot in the way of complexity. And so then we can go back and look at many of these types of self-assembled materials, especially in biology, and think about what the role of entropy might be there. It also has applications in the field of granular matter, processing of particles, of sand grains, packaging of pharmaceuticals, M&Ms packed in a package, or diamond-shaped Skittles. How you might design the package to fit the most number of Skittles in a box.
So whenever I'm looking to design the perfectly shaped candy for packing purposes, I will consult this paper.
Yes, absolutely.
Sharon Glotzer, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Sharon Glotzer and colleagues write about entropy and the self-assembly of nanoparticles in this week's Science.
Would you support sending our elderly out to the front lines of the battlefield? Evolution seems to favor this decision, at least in one species of termite, in which elderly individuals take on sacrificial roles in battle. As the termites age and can no longer serve the colony by chewing wood, pouches containing a deadly mixture of chemicals begin to grow on their backs. When disturbed, the chemicals mix together and erupt to trap surrounding attackers in toxic goo. Senior author Yves Royson spoke with me from his office in Brussels, where he began by describing these toxic pouches.
Well, actually, they carry a kind of backpack, which allows them to explode, and they release a sticky and toxic substance. And so it's actually a two-component system. The backpack is actually a pocket outside of the body, which contains a pair of blue crystals. And then within the abdomen, there are stores of secretions from the salivary glands. And so when they explode, the two mix together and they produce the toxic secretion.
So what can you tell me about this species of termite?
Well, they're social insects, of course. So there must be a queen in the colonies, a king. Then lots of brood, the young ones. And then soldiers and also workers. And among the workers, we distinguish the white ones and blue ones. The blue ones are the ones with the blue crystals, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, those blue workers are old ones. They are older workers. And we could tell this because their mandibles get worn when they chew on wood. They are wood feeders. So the mandibles get worn, and we can tell they are the older workers.
And how do you measure how worn the mandibles are?
Oh, we have to dissect them and measure the length of the edge of the mandible. If they are sharp, the edge is longer than if they are blunt, just a microscopic technique.
Mm-hmm. So how did you test whether these backpacks were helpful in battle?
Well, actually, we observed, of course, the termites explode when they are grabbed by another termite or a predator or by ourselves. And then we tested by removing the crystals. Since they are outside of the body, they can be removed. If you cool the termite, you can remove the crystals without making it explode. So you can remove them and then test if they are toxic without the crystals, or transplant the crystals to a white worker and see that white workers become more toxic with the crystals. So we can make transplantation experiments.
So what did you see when you transplanted the crystals?
Actually, we showed that the two components are important, the crystals and the secretion of the labial glands. And actually, when they explode, then they release some toxic substances. The blue color disappears, indicating the reaction.
So getting into this blue color, what exactly is it?
It's actually a protein containing copper.
Mm-hmm.
So there are several kinds of copper-containing proteins in animals, in arthropods. So we are now trying to find out exactly what kind of protein this is. Many have an oxidizing action.
It's pretty much these termites are sacrificing their older individuals for
yes.
A suicidal battle.
quite common in social insects because they usually send the older ones outside to forage, to collect food, and so they are more implied in battles, in encounters with enemies or predators.
Mm-hmm.
And in such insects, of course, the individual doesn't really count, or it counts by the work it can actually do for the colony. And when they are old, then probably less efficient, they are more likely to sacrifice themselves.
Mm-hmm.
No, in non-social animals, of course, they tend to be more selfish, always.
Yeah, of course.
So probably they won't do that.
So this chemical toxin, is this similar to sort of other insects that have venom in their stingers?
Well, this is very original because it's a two-component system. And this is not common at all in insects. So there are a few ants that also possess a two-component system. They have two glands tied to the sting.
Mm-hmm.
And they can also mix the two substances. But it's really, really uncommon. So many of them carry venom, of course, in their poison gland. Many ants do.
Mm-hmm.
It's also exceptional to have the animal really carrying one component outside of the body. I don't know of any other animal doing this.
Since this seems to be a highly evolved defense, are there other non-blue workers hesitant to engage in battle with a blue worker? Do they seem to be wary of individuals that are older and likely to explode?
Well, I don't think so. I don't think they can identify the opponent like this. When they get to know the opponent, it's too late.
Mm-hmm.
Or they don't have the opportunity to learn, at least for insects. So maybe for other animals, such as vertebrates, I don't know, lizards that could be predators, then probably they could identify the exploding workers. We are now interested in the evolution of this kind of defense.
Because, okay.
Of course, it's a two-component system, so it doesn't evolve so easily because one component alone is probably not really efficient. And so we are trying to see what's happening in related species.
Mm-hmm.
So this species is, well, it's a genus Neocapritermes, which comes from South America. And there are quite a lot of species in this genus, but so far we observed this behavior only in one of them. So we will try to check what's happening in the other species and where this defensive device can come from.
So trying to find the origin.
Yes, trying to do the phylogeny of the group and so seeing if there are adaptations in other species that could explain the evolution of the two-component explosive system.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing we are doing with this termite is now try to identify the biochemical mechanisms. So exactly what's the secretion of the salivary glands and how does it react with the blue crystals? What's exactly the protein? That's what we are studying now.
Thank you, Yves Roysen.
Thank you.
Yves Roysen and colleagues describe exploding backpacks in a neotropical termite in a brief in this week's issue.
When first approaching another planet, we play it coy by doing a simple flyby. Just a day or so to examine one side of a planet. Next comes the orbiter, circling and collecting data on the whole planet. Step 3, send in the rovers to do some on-the-ground reporting. That's the normal progression of planetary exploration in our solar system, and NASA is itching to take the next step, returning samples from the surface of another planet. Sarah Crespi spoke with science news writer Richard Kerr about who will be making the next trip to Mars, humans or robots.
There was a National Research Council committee which last spring came out with what's called the Planetary Decadal Survey. It's a consensus document. They've essentially polled the planetary community and come up with a list of what are the most desirable missions for the next decade. They come up with a list. It's three-tiered, several small missions, a couple of medium-sized missions, and then one multi-billion dollar so-called flagship mission. And in this last decadal survey, the top priority for a flagship mission was to collect and return samples from the surface of Mars.
And so this is something that you called an aspirational mission. What does that mean?
Well, maybe that's a NASA term. NASA is very interested in inspiring everyone to greater ambitions, whether it's elementary students to take an interest in science, or Congress to fund space exploration. The idea is to set high, challenging goals that will deliver great science, but also will inspire and egg people on to even greater achievements.
And so one thing that seems aspirational to me is to put a person on Mars. And that does come up in your story, but that might not be the goal that the scientists want who want to do this sample return mission.
Well, NASA's most aspirational endeavors definitely involve humans. Mm-hmm. Human exploration. It is NASA. Planetary science has usually been on a parallel track. They have come together on occasion. The Apollo astronauts returned almost 400 kilograms of precious rock samples from the moon. But it doesn't always turn out well for the scientists, or not as well as might have been hoped.
Is that because they have to take their focus off of some of the analysis equipment? Or?
Well, there's always a tension between robotic science exploration and human exploration. Their interests overlap, but the overlap is not always that great. And the human exploration program is much more expensive, maybe 10 times, 100 times more expensive. And so it doesn't always work out the way the scientists would like. They were very pleased with the Apollo rock samples, but they were expecting a more thorough investigation of the moon. And then again, in recent years, NASA was working under President Bush's directive, was going to return astronauts to the moon. Mm-hmm. And the scientists were on board. They got several missions, successful missions, to return terabytes of data. But President Obama changed the vision that NASA is operating under, and now NASA is going to be sending astronauts to an asteroid so that eventually someday they can get to Mars. The ultimate destination has always been Mars, but we're just shifting the pathway. And when the pathway gets shifted, one group of scientists lose out, maybe another one gains.
Well, let's talk about the sample return mission a little bit more. So the idea is to send something to Mars that can pick up some soil there and bring it back, right? Can you talk about how that would work?
Well, there's a very general concept that people have in mind, but everybody sees it as a three-step process. The Decadal Survey recommended taking the first step in this decade, and that would be a mission to Mars, a rover that could rove around, see what looks really interesting, and pick up some rocks. But that doesn't get them back home.
Yeah.
So you need a second mission, a second multi-billion-dollar mission. Goes down, lands very close to that first rover, takes on its samples, and blasts them up into Mars orbit.
Wow.
Then you need a third multi-billion-dollar mission, and you need to have them all work. The third one rendezvous in Mars orbit and brings the samples back to Earth.
Are you sure it wouldn't be cheaper just to send a person up there?
Well, sending humans to Mars has its own challenges. And there's actually some ongoing discussion about, do you have the robots bring the samples back first, or do you send the humans and have them bring them back? Mm-hmm. The thinking seems to be going toward robotic return of samples first. Humans, they're very expensive. They're also filthy dirty. You want to know more about Mars before you send the humans there. I mean, what's lurking in that Mars soil might be something living, maybe not. There might be something that would be unhealthy for the astronauts. The scientists see that as a driving force to get their samples even before the humans get there.
So you mentioned the Decadal Survey. It lists out some of the main missions, the priorities for the space program. What were some of the top contenders?
Well, the committee did prioritize four or five missions. Mars sample return was a top one. Mm-hmm. Next was sending an orbiter to the Jovian moon Europa. Once again, there's potential life involved. Europa has a deep ocean beneath its icy surface. And scientists are very interested in the nature of that ocean and the possibility of life there. Next one was sending an orbiter to Uranus. It's one of the outermost outer planets. It's had only one mission, a flyby, and it's an interesting planet, gassy on the outside and a lot of ice on the inside. It's a sort of planet that is turning up around a lot of other stars. And then the last priority was an either-or deal, a mission to study Venus climate, or the alternative there was a mission to Enceladus. This is a small icy moon of Saturn. It's spewing tiny ice particles, kind of like icy geysers. And scientists are coming to believe that there's an ocean under there, too, which they're interested in for astrobiological purposes as well.
So those are all pretty interesting options if the Mars sample return mission doesn't work out. But kind of before any of that happens, we need to see how the funding shakes out. How is that playing out right now?
Well, NASA failed to sell Mars sample return to the Obama administration. It was a bit too much for them to swallow, apparently. So in this budget round, it looks like there's going to be some alternative means proposed. And whatever that alternative pathway is going to involve human exploration. President Obama has directed NASA, said it should send humans to Mars by the mid-2030s. Now, that's to orbit Mars. But he did say that will be followed by a landing on Mars soon enough that he will be able to witness it. So we're talking the 2040s. So NASA is reformulating the Mars science program in some way that they can still get Mars sample return at some point in the future.
Well, Richard Kerr, thanks so much for talking with me.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Richard Kerr is a staff writer for Science. He writes about planetary exploration in a News Focus this week.
Finally, we have Nicholas St. Fleur to give us a rundown of some of the stories from our daily news site. First off, we have a pretty interesting story about artificial jellyfish. So these researchers created a sort of Frankenjelly. What does a real jellyfish have to do to move?
So jellyfish move rather rhythmically. What they do is they flex their muscles and then they expel water, taking on a dome shape as they glide through the water.
So how on earth do you make a fake jellyfish?
Well, what these scientists did was, after analyzing how the jellyfish moves and how the jellyfish acts and more of its mechanics, they took silicone and transplanted cells from a rat's heart to make the shape of the jellyfish. So it's a silicone schematic powered by rat DNA.
Okay, that's really cool. But I know the scientists went through a lot of trial and error to get the Frankenjelly to actually swim. So what were some of the problems with their design and how did they overcome their obstacles?
Some of the different problems they faced were designing the correct type of silicone layers to best mimic the different types of movements that this jellyfish creates. Another problem that they had was actually bringing it to life. So what they did was they put the Frankenjelly into some salt water, they ran an electric current, and then, boom, it's alive. It's like Frankenstein straight out of the classic.
So Frankenstein has his new pet.
Exactly.
Okay, but this all goes beyond fake jellyfish. What are some of the more practical applications of this technology?
So the main application of this activity is in creating new heart devices, artificial heart devices. The synthetic jellyfish comes into play because the motions that the jellyfish uses to move are comparable to the same motions that the heart valve uses to pump. When the heart's beating, it has a valve, and the valve lets blood come in and go out, much in the same way that the synthetic jellyfish moves.
Mm-hmm.
So by applying this type of technology to future heart valves, they may be able to make better heart valves, and they could also use this technology to test out different types of heart medicine, heart drugs, by testing it on the actual synthetic jellyfish to see how it makes that jellyfish react.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So jellyfish may end up saving our lives someday.
So next off, we move to what seems like a scene from a teenage horror film, as you put it. In our next story, we have bats preying on copulating houseflies. Now, we know that bats typically find their prey through echolocation, but the situation is a little bit different here, isn't it?
So typically, bats use echolocation to find their prey. With echolocation, the bat sends out signals that bounce around the surrounding environment and send back echoes that the bat can pick up.
Mm-hmm.
It's like looking into a dark room with a strobe light. So this is normally how bats find their prey. But that wasn't the case in this instance. So what you have here is a cow shed that's covered with about 9,000 flies.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty stinky area.
Yeah.
The flies are just buzzing around during the day. But at night, they fly to the ceilings and they go to sleep or they do other activities.
Like what?
Like copulation. So when the flies rest on the ceiling, they're actually protected from the bat's echolocation. So when the bat sends out his signal and it hits the ceiling, well, this ceiling is covered with a bunch of tiny bumps, which are about the same size as the flies. So when that signal comes back, instead of seeing where the flies are, the bat gets a message full of bumps, little tiny bumps that it can't discern whether what it's seeing is a bump or a fly.
Mm-hmm. So if they're invisible, how are the bats able to find them?
That's exactly what the researchers were trying to find out. The bats were able to pick up on a certain noise that the flies made while they were mating. It was a clicking noise, which to us sounds more like a buzz. But to the bats, it was more of a signal telling them that there's something going on over here. So what the researchers found is that the bats would hear this noise, home in on it, and then fly to the copulating flies, swoop them up in a process known as gleaning, which is when a bat takes a prey off of a surface. So they'd swoop in, grab the flies, and head out with a two-for-one dinner.
How did the experimenters actually confirm that it was the buzzing noise that attracted the bats?
Well, that's a great question. So what the researchers had to find out was whether it was a clicking noise that the flies were making that cued in the bats, or if it was just having two flies on the ceiling, which created a larger target for echolocation.
Mm-hmm.
So what they did was they set up four speakers hanging from the ceilings that would play recordings of the copulating flies. So it would play that clicking noise. So when the researchers played this noise, the bats would come in and attack the actual speakers, thinking it was prey.
Mm-hmm. So if buzzing can get them eaten up, then why don't the flies keep the noise down?
So what the researchers found is that it's actually the male housefly that makes this noise, this clicking noise. So looking at previous studies, what different researchers found is that the clicking noise is part of the male fly's courtship ritual. So the male fly will click his wings to show the female that he's basically worthy to mate with. The female would only allow the male fly to mate with her after he produced these sounds. So no noise, no mating.
From houseflies dying in the throes of passion to Neanderthals perishing in Central and Eastern Europe. But for Neanderthals, the reason seems a bit less certain. So there's a long-standing debate over just why the Neanderthals disappeared. What are people saying about this? What are the two sides?
So right now, scientists aren't too sure why the Neanderthals disappeared. There's a theory that the Neanderthals were killed off by humans, Homo sapiens, who were emerging around the same time period. There's also the theory that climate change may have led to their demise. And there's another theory that a super volcanic eruption helped cause their ultimate destruction.
Okay, so we have a lot of things going on here. The presence of modern humans, the eruption, the cold spell, and the disappearance of the Neanderthals. So what was the solution the scientists came up with to find the correct sort of order, the timings?
First is the idea that this super volcanic eruption occurred around 40,000 years ago. So recently, scientists found out that this particular eruption was actually 2 to 3 times more massive than they had thought. With the explosion comes massive amounts of volcanic ash, which was thought to be linked to a climate change that happened at that period, in which globally the temperatures were cooled by 2 to 3 degrees. What the scientists tried to discover was whether or not this massive explosion happened before the Neanderthals disappeared, or after the Neanderthals disappeared. Mm-hmm. So what the scientists investigated was a different type of volcanic glass. Mm-hmm. So this type of volcanic glass was much smaller and easier to detect at a wider range than the previous study that mm-hmm. looked at this.
So it spread out to sites that had previously been inaccessible to them?
Right. They looked to see where those glass pieces were in relation to Neanderthal tools and human tools. So by looking at the sedimentary layers, they found the time period when Neanderthal tools were no longer used and Homo sapien tools started taking over. So this time period signified when Neanderthals died out and when Homo sapiens came to predominate. So after looking at this region, they found that the glass particles were on top of this region, meaning that they were younger particles than the layer at which Homo sapien tools predominated over Neanderthal tools. So what this means is that this volcanic explosion happened after the Neanderthals died out.
So what does this tell us about the climate change theory?
So this finding isn't conclusive in completely ruling out that climate change may have had a hand in the Neanderthals disappearing. So basically, that adds stronger evidence that humans, not volcanic explosions, were the cause of the Neanderthals dying out.
So what are some other stories we have on our online daily news site?
One story we have on the website is about selfish sheep and the reasons why they stay in the herd. Another story we have is about how scientists recreated mother of pearl, which is the mineral material inside of shells. So from Science Insider this week, we have a story about conflicts of interest and fracking. And then this week in Science Live, where we chat about the hottest topics in science, we have a discussion on invasive species and whether or not they're misunderstood. For next week's Science Live, we have a chat about the landing of the Mars rover. Be sure to check out these stories and more at news.sciencemag.org.
Thanks, Nick. Nick is an intern at the Science News site. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog Science Insider at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the July 27th, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Edward Hermy. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.